Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009. Reading Eduardo Galeano is a tonic for the mind and sustenance for the soul. We may despair at the inequities in the world, but Galeano reminds us that reality is not destiny, it's a challenge. We are not doomed to accept it as it is. How do we avoid becoming cynical when change seems impossible? Galeano reminds us by keeping alive the memory of dignity, by telling and repeating that we are not born last year, we are born from a long tradition of betrayals, but also a long tradition of dignity. Eduardo Galeano was the first recipient of the Lannan Prize for Cultural Freedom. His works have been translated into 28 languages, and they include Memory of Fire, the three volumes, Soccer and Sun and Shadow, Days and Nights of Love and War, The Book of Embraces, We Say No, Walking Words, Upside Down, and Voices of Time. Most of you here, I'm sure, are quite familiar or long familiar with Eduardo Galeano's work. He is, after all, one of Latin America's most distinguished writers. After April 18th, when Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez gave President Obama a copy of Galeano's 1971 work, Open Veins of Latin America, Five Centuries of the Pillage of a Continent, a great many more Americans joined that circle of admiration. But we want you to know that we had booked Eduardo long before that, so we're not slaves to fashion. Galeano's works transcend orthodox genres and combine documentary, fiction, journalism, political analysis, and history, though he does not consider himself a historian, rather a writer obsessed with remembering the past of America above all, and above all that of Latin America, intimate land condemned to amnesia. His newest book, Mirrors, Stories of Almost Everyone, is his perhaps most ambitious work to date, and that's saying a lot. In 600 short, poignant vignettes, Galeano examines the oral and written histories of our world, from creation myths and stories of the origins of language to culture and current events of the 21st century. Reading Mirrors offers the opportunity to rethink one's notion of history and what connects us to the rest of humanity, to stones, to animals, and gods as well. So please welcome Eduardo Galeano to the Los Angeles Public Library.
I won't say good night. I learned during these years, but the first time I came to the United States, I had a reading in New York, and I began it saying good night. And everybody laughed, of course, and I thought, nice people, they are so nice. They are so generous, so nice. I learned. My English is far from perfect, but I learned to say good evening and thank you for coming. I will read some stories from Mirrors, the latest book I committed, and beginning with a dedication, Being as It Is, a book about the invisible people. I will begin dedicating the reading to an invisible founding father of the United States. Robert Carter was buried in the garden. In his will, he asked to be laid under a shady tree where he might be undisturbed and sleep in peace in obscurity, no stone nor inscription. This Virginia patrician was one of the richest, if not the richest, of all the prosperous landowners who broke ties with England. Although several other founding fathers looked askance at slavery, none of them freed their slaves. Carter was the only one to unchain the 450 blacks he owned, to allow them to live and work according to their own will and pleasure. He freed them 70 years before Abraham Lincoln abolished slavery, and he did so gradually, taking care that none of them was simply turned out and deserted. Such folly condemned him to solitude and oblivion. He was cut off by his friends, his neighbors, and his family, all of whom were convinced that free blacks were a threat to personal and national security. And later on, his acts were rewarded with collective amnesia. And then let's go to the name of the book to begin. It's called Mirrors. The great Argentinian writer, José Luis Borges, hated mirrors and hated sex. He hated sex because sex multiplies people, and he hated mirrors because mirrors also multiply people. Well, about sex, I don't have yet an opinion, but about mirrors, I can tell you, I love mirrors exactly for the same reason, because they multiply people. And mirrors are full of people, full of those invisibles, unknown by the official history, scorned, despised by those who write history. And this would give us the possibility to say some words about the cover of the book. I suppose most of them have seen it. I don't know if there is a book near here. Somebody has the book. Well, this beautiful face, marvelous sculpture there. And this is the story of the cover. Some people wonder why I chose this image and where does it come from. West African sculptures have always sung while they worked, and they do not stop singing until their sculptures are finished. In that way, the music gets inside the carvings and keeps on singing. In 1910, Leo Frobenius found ancient sculptures on the slave coast that made his eyes bulge. Their beauty was such that the German explorer believed they were Greek, brought from Athens, or perhaps from the lost Atlantis. His colleagues agreed, Africa, daughter of scorn, mother of slaves, could not have produced such marvels. It did, though. Those music-filled effigies had been sculpted a few centuries previous in the belly bottom of the world, in Ife, the sacred place where the Yoruba gods gave birth to women and men. Africa turned out to be an unending wellspring of art worth celebrating and worth stealing. It seems Paul Gauguin, a rather absent-minded fellow, put his name on a couple of sculptures from the Congo, and the error was contagious. From then on, Picasso, Modigliani, Klee, Giacometti, Ernst, Moore, and many, many other European artists made the same mistake and did so with alarming frequency. Pillaged by its colonial masters, Africa would never know how responsible it was for the most astonishing achievements in 20th century European art. And after The Contain, what's the book about? There is one of the initial stories which may be eloquent. How would the Trojan War have been told by an unknown soldier? A Greek food soldier ignored by the gods and desired only by the vultures that circled the battlefields? A farmer fighter, hymned by no one, sculptured by no one, a nobody, an everybody, obliged to kill, and without the slightest interest in being killed to win Helen's eyes. Would that soldier have predicted what Euripides later confirmed, that Helen never was in Troy, only her shadow, that 10 years of butchery occurred for the sake of an empty tunic? And if that soldier survived, what would he recall? Who knows, maybe the smell of pain, and only that. 3,000 years after the fall of Troy, war correspondents Robert Fisk and Fran Sevilla tell us that wars stink. They have been in several wars on the inside, and they know the hot, sweet, sticky stench of decay that gets into your pores and takes up residence in your body. Here. There they are, painted on the walls and roofs of caves, bison, elk, birds, horses, eagles, women, men. These figures are ageless. They were born thousands upon thousands of years ago, but they are born anew every time someone looks on them. How could he, our ancestor of long ago, paint so delicately? How could a brute who fought wild beasts with his bare hands, create images so filled with grace? How did he manage to draw those flying lines that break free of the stone and take to the air? How could he? Or was it she? Another one about to begin with the invisibles, about this the half of humanity. Someone called minority. I'm not strong in mathematics, but I cannot understand how the half of something may be a minority. And we are trained to know and to denounce the situation of past and present of women and their religious systems of power. But it's not so known what happened with the French Revolution, for instance. French Revolution had nothing to do with the church. They were enemies of the church. But the symbols of the French Revolution are female, women of marble or bronze with powerful naked breasts, Phrygian caps, flags of flutter. But what the revolution produced was the declaration of the rights of man and the citizen. And when revolutionary militant Olympe de Gouges proposed a declaration of the rights of woman and the female citizen, she was hauled off to jail. A revolutionary tribunal found her guilty, and the guillotine removed her head. At the foot of the scaffold, Olympe asked, "If we women have the right to go to the guillotine, should we not also have the right to go to the tribune?" Not allowed. They could not speak, they could not vote. The convention, the Revolutionary Congress, closed down all women's political associations and forbade women from debating men as equals. Olympe de Gouges' companions were sent to the lunatic asylum, and soon after her execution, it was the turn of Manon Rolland. Manon was the wife of a minister of the government, but not even that could save her. She was found guilty of, quote, "an antinatural tendency to political activism," end of the quote. She had betrayed her feminine nature, which was to keep house and give birth to brave sons, and she had committed the deadly offense of sticking her nose into the masculine affairs of state, and the guillotine dropped once more. There are a lot of stories about women in mirrors. And some of my evil friends, I have a lot of evil friends, asked me, of course, what about Condoleezza Rice? Nobody's perfect. Thousands of unburied dead wander the Argentinian Pampa. They are the disappeared from the last military dictatorship. General Jorge Videla and his henchmen used disappearance as a weapon of war on a scale never before seen. He used it, but he did not invent it. A century beforehand, against Argentina's native peoples, General Julio Argentino Roca employed the same masterpiece of cruelty, disappearances, which obliges each victim to die and die again and go on dying, while his loved ones lose their minds chasing his elusive shadow. In Argentina, as in all of the Americas, the Indians were the first disappeared. They disappeared before they even appeared. General Roca called his invasion of Indian lands the conquest of the desert. Patagonia was an empty space, a kingdom of nothing, inhabited by no one. After that, Indians continued disappearing. Those who surrendered and gave up their land and everything else were called Indios Reducidos, reduced to the point of disappearing. And those who did not surrender and were defeated by gunfire and sword blows disappeared into numbers, becoming the nameless dead of military body counts, and their children disappeared too, divided up as war booty, called by other names, emptied of memory. They became little slaves for the murderers of their parents. Official history has it that Vasco Núñez de Balboa, the Spanish conqueror, was the first man to see the two oceans at once from a summit in Panama. Were the natives blind? Who first gave names to corn and potatoes and tomatoes and chocolate and the mountains and rivers of America? Hernán Cortés, Francisco Pizarro? Were the natives mute? The pilgrims on the Mayflower heard him. God said America was the promised land. Were the natives deaf? Later on, the grandchildren of those pilgrims of the North seized the name and everything else. Now they are the Americans. And those of us who live in the other Americas, who are we? Martians, marcianos. ¿Qué mierda somos? Adam and Eve were black. The human voyage in the world began in Africa. From there, our ancestors set out to conquer the planet. Many paths led them to many destinies, and the sun took care of handing out colors from the palette. Now the rainbow of the earth is more colorful than the rainbow of the sky, but we all are immigrants from Africa. Even the whitest of whites comes from Africa. Maybe we refuse to concede our common origin because racism causes amnesia, or because we find it unbelievable that in those days long past, the entire world was our kingdom. And in this immense map, without borders, legs were the only passport required. At the height of a wave of lynchings, D.W. Griffith's film, The Birth of a Nation, sings a hymn of praise to the Ku Klux Klan. This is Hollywood's first blockbuster and the greatest box office success ever for a silent movie. It is also the first film that ever opened at the White House. President Woodrow Wilson gives it a standing ovation. Applauding it, he applauds himself. Wilson, the famous flag bearer of freedom, wrote most of the texts that accompany the epic images. The president's words explain that the emancipation of the slaves was, quote, a veritable overthrow of civilization in the South, the white South under the heel of the black South, end of the quote. Ever since, chaos reigns, because blacks are, quote, men who knew none of the uses of authority except its insolences. End of the quote, and a new quote, because the President Wilson lights the lamp of hope, writing, at last there had sprung into existence a great Ku Klux Klan. And even Jesus himself comes down from heaven at the end of the movie to give his blessing. Fortunately, the United States have a quite different president nowadays. Brunete, Spain, 1937. Oliver Law is black and red and a working man. He left Chicago to fight for the Spanish Republic in the ranks of the Lincoln Brigade. In the brigade, blacks do not form a separate regiment. For the first time in the history of the United States, whites and blacks mix. And for the first time in the history of the United States, white soldiers obey the orders of a black commanding officer. An unusual commander. When Oliver Law gives the order to attack, he does not watch his men through binoculars. He is the first to join the fight. But then all of the volunteers in the international brigades are unusual, quite unusual. They do not fight to win medals or conquer land or capture oil wells. Sometimes Oliver wonders, since this Spanish War is a war between whites, who for centuries have held us in slavery, why am I a Negro? Why am I here? And he answers, we came to wipe out the fascists. And laughing, he adds, as if it were a joke, some of us must die doing the job. Brunete, summer of 1937. Oliver Law takes a bullet in the breast. Another story from Spain, 1 year before the military coup against democracy in Spain, when elections were coming. In the outskirts of Sevilla, outskirts of Seville, one winter of 1936, the Spanish elections are imminent. A gentleman is riding about his lands, vast lands, when a man in tatters crosses his path. Without getting off his horse, the gentleman calls him over and puts in his hand a coin and a list of candidates. The man lets them fall, coin and list. And turning his back, he says, in my hunger, I'm in charge. En mi hambre, mando yo. A homage to my dear masters, Mark Twain and Ambrose Bierce. Some months after invading Iraq, President George W. Bush said his model had been the War of Philippines. Both wars were inspired from heaven. Bush disclosed that God had ordered him to act as he did. He didn't explain how. By mail, by phone, by fax. And a century beforehand, President William McKinley also heard the voice from the great beyond. God told me, he said, that we could not leave the Filipinos to themselves. They were unfit for self-government. There was nothing left for us to do but to take them all and to educate them and uplift and civilize and Christianize them. Thus, the Philippines were liberated from the Filipino threat, and along the way, the United States also saved Cuba, Puerto Rico, Honduras, Colombia, Panama, Dominican Republic, Hawaii, Guam, Samoa. At the time, writer Ambrose Bierce revealed, "War is God's way of teaching us geography." And his colleague, Mark Twain, leader of the Anti-Imperialist League, designed a new flag for the nation, featuring little skulls in place of stars. General Frederick Thurston suggested Twain ought to be hanged for treason. Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn defended their father. And speaking about fathers, something about the father of the computers. I should begin to confess that I had strong prejudices against computers. Perhaps because I felt that computers drink at night when nobody sees them. They drink whiskey and rum and beer and wine and everything. And that's why they do strange things during the daytime. Ununderstandable things that are just hangover. Clearly it was hangover. But finally I changed my mind and I accepted that computers are quite useful and I'm using. I'm a handwriter, I mean I write by hand, but later I go on working with computers, with my computer, and it's quite useful. I mean, I'm not the machine of my machine. I'm not programmed by my computer. I'm not the tool of my tool, and therefore I should begin saying, all of us should begin saying, when we turn on our computer, should begin saying thank you to the inventor of the computer, the father, who was an Englishman called Alan Turing. And I'll read this text because the book includes some stories, being as it is, a homage to human diversity, includes some stories about sexual diversity, which is also a treasure of humankind, because the best we have is so many people inside, like mirrors. The best of the world is in the so many worlds that the world contains. The human rainbow, full of colors, diverse, different. Working for British intelligence, Alan Turing helped shorten the Second World War when he invented a machine that could crack the impenetrable military codes used by Germany's high command. At that point, he had already dreamed up a prototype of an electronic computer and had laid out the theoretical basis for today's information systems. Later on, he led the team that built the first computer to operate with integrated programs. He played interminable chess games with the computer, and asked her questions that drove it nuts. And he insisted that it write him love letters, but the machine responded emitting messages rather incoherent. But they were not machines. They were not machines. There were flesh and blood Manchester policemen who arrested him in 1952 for gross indecency. At the trial, Turing pled guilty to being a homosexual. Homosexuality was at that time a crime and also a sickness. So to be set free, he agreed to undergo a medical treatment to cure him of the affliction. And the bombardment of drugs left him impotent, and he grew breasts, and he stayed indoors, no longer went to the university. He heard murmurs, felt stairs drilling into his back. He had the habit of eating an apple before going to bed. And one night, he injected cyanide into the apple he was about to eat. El amor que pasa, la vida que pesa, la muerte que pisa. Hay dolores inevitables y así es nomás. Y ni modo. Pero las autoridades planetarias agregan dolor al dolor y encima nos cobran ese favor que nos hacen. En dinero contante y sonante pagamos cada día el impuesto al valor agregado y en desdicha contante y sonante pagamos cada día el impuesto al dolor agregado. El dolor agregado se disfraza de fatalidad del destino como si fueran la misma cosa, la angustia que nace de la fugacidad de la vida y la angustia que nace de la fugacidad del empleo. Love wanes, life wakes, death wastes. Some griefs are inevitable. That's the way it is, and not much can be done about it. But those in charge of the planet pile grief on top of grief and then charge us for the favor. We pay the value-added tax every day in cold, hard cash, and every day in cold, hard misfortune, we pay the grief-added tax. The added sorrow comes disguised as fate or destiny, as if the anguish born of the fleeting life were the same as the anguish born of the fleeting jobs. Something about the a symbol of our time. Symbol of our time. Walls. The Berlin Wall was on the news every day. From morning till night we read and saw and heard the wall of shame, the wall of infamy, the iron curtain. In the end, this wall, which deserved to fall, fell. But other walls sprouted and continue sprouting across the world, even though they are much larger than the one in Berlin. We hear little or nothing about them. Little said about the wall the United States is building along the Mexican border, and little said about the barbed wire barriers surrounding the Spanish enclaves in the African coast. Practically nothing is said about the West Bank Wall, which perpetuates the Israeli occupation of Palestinian lands and will be 15 times longer than the Berlin Wall. And nothing at all is said about the Morocco Wall, which perpetuates the seizure of the Saharan homeland by the Kingdom of Morocco and is 60 times the length of the Berlin Wall. Why are some walls so loud and others mute? This is in some way related to my recent experience in this literary tour I'm doing. I come from 9 cities, and I am fortunately enough ending it because it's difficult to go from one airport to another. Airports are very difficult places nowadays. Something like torture chambers. I don't know, but if my inspiration finish and I'm unable to write, then I may become, perfectly well become, a stripper, because I have done something like 25 or 26 sessions of striptease sex in the airport, yes, yeah, successfully. So now I have another profession, and this is always useful. Sleeping, she saw us. Elena dreamed we were waiting in line at an airport, a long, long line, where every passenger had under the arm the pillow on which he or she had slept the night before. The pillows were sent through a dream reading machine. The machine detected any dangerous dreams that threatened to disturb the peace. The 20th century was born proclaiming peace and justice, but it died bathed in blood and passed on a world much more unjust than the one it inherited. The 21st century, which also arrived heralding peace and justice, is following in its predecessor's footsteps. In my childhood, when I was a child, I was convinced that everything that went astray on earth ended up on the moon. But the astronauts found no sign of dangerous dreams or broken promises or hopes betrayed. If not on the moon, where might they be? Perhaps they were never misplaced. Perhaps they are in hiding here on earth, waiting, esperándonos, a nosotros, los humanitos. Darwin told us we are cousins of the apes, not the angels. And later on we learned we emerged from Africa's jungle and that no stork ever carried us from Paris. And not long ago we discovered that our genes are almost identical to those of mice. Now we can't tell if we are God's masterpiece or the devil's bad joke. We puny humans, exterminators of everything, hunters of our own, creators of the atom bomb, the hydrogen bomb, and the neutron bomb, which is the healthiest of all bombs since it vaporizes people but leaves objects intact. We, the only animals who invent machines, the only ones who live at the service of the machines they invent, the only ones who devour their own home, the only ones who poison the water they drink and the earth that feeds them, the only ones capable of renting or selling themselves, or renting or selling their fellow humans, the only ones who kill for fun, the only ones who torture, the only ones who rape, and also, the only ones who laugh, the only ones who daydream, the ones who make silk from the spit of a worm, the ones who find beauty in rubbish, the ones who discover colors beyond the rainbow, the ones who nourish the voices of the world with new music, and who create words so that neither reality nor memory will be mute. Y también. Los únicos que ríen, los únicos que sueñan despiertos, los que hacen seda de la baba del gusano, los que convierten la basura en hermosura, los que descubren colores que el arco iris no conoce, los que dan nuevas músicas a las voces del mundo y crean palabras para que no sean mudas la realidad ni su memoria. Thank you. Written questions.
Yeah, we're gathering them. Ah. They're getting the questions.
Well, let's begin with this. It's in Spanish. ¿Qué le sugeriría usted a Obama hacer para los próximos años? And what would you suggest President Obama to do in the next years? And later, there is a long sentence about recordarle la muerte de miles de inmigrantes and other disagreeable memories. But what should I suggest him? It's okay, this? Yes?
Yeah, you
It's all right?
Yes.
Well, there is something, I was, during all the campaign, I was hearing his speeches, and later also. I think the election of Obama is very important in this country, and very important for the world, because we are still suffering racism in the world. So I think it's a very positive news, very good news, the election of President Obama. But what would I suggest him? It sounds a little pedantic, no? I mean, who am I to suggest anything to the president of the first country in the world? Perhaps I would suggest him to begin using one word instead of another word. There is a word he uses, like all the U.S. politicians, very, very frequently, and I think it's a horrible word. Leadership, 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 leadership. Let's change it to friendship. This would be my main suggestion. Oh, no, no.
You don't think so?
Poor Obama, with all the problems he had. Poor man. Obliging him to read open things. No, it's too much. There are some questions regarding the terrorism. And I would just say that I was surprised, astonished, last year in 2008, when I read it was not an important news for the papers or the TV stations or radio, just a few. Almost not important at all for them, but very important for me. I was amazed. I didn't know that Nelson Mandela had been officially considered a terrorist in the United States during 60 years, up to the year 2008, last year. He was in the lists as a terrorist. It's unbelievable. Each time he came here, he needed a special permission, being a terrorist, obviously, not just a tourist. It's surrealistic. I mean, what do they mean when they say terrorist? People like Nelson Mandela, I may become a terrorist. And tomorrow I shall be included in the list of terrorists. And 60 years later, I'll be free from it. But 60 years, I'm afraid I shall be un poquitito muertito. I don't know. All of them are very good questions.
Do you want to see who's asked them? We can have the person raise their hand if you say the question.
Very good questions. Well, some questions about the crisis, this crisis, which began here, but it's now a world crisis. And it's quite a subject, the crisis. I came from a southern country, and all the south of the world was, during the last 30 or 40 years, obliged to accept the religion of market as the only possible religion. And then our states, our public powers were annihilated, were destroyed by the international organizations like the World Bank, the FMI, and other philanthropic institutions. And then everything was privatized, and we began accepting the orders of our creditors, which were the real governors in each one of our countries, deciding even the speed of the flight of the flies, el vuelo de las moscas, the flight of the flies, and everything else, the salaries, the value of the money, everything. And then when the state was non-existent, except as an executor and as a jail guardian, it happened, the crisis exploded here, and in a hurry, the state in the United States and in other rich countries or powerful countries went on to help the market, because the market was shipwrecking. After so many years, we were dancing the salsa of the technocrats, but it was the orchestra of the Titanic who was giving us that beautiful music. And now they, the authors of this massacre, of this disaster in all the southern countries, when the crisis happened, immediately remembered that the state is very important. And so the state is now rewarding the responsibles of the crisis, the real pirates in our world, because we read in the newspapers and hear in the news still speaking about the pirates, dangerous pirates in the Somalian coast, all these have-nots, these poor, hungry people who assault ships. But I think they are saints compared to the real pirates, the Wall Street bankers who assaulted the world, the entire world, not a ship in the Somalian coast. And it's like the answer the government at the beginning of Bush government, and now even the Obama government, is like a Robin Hood answer, but upside down, a Hood Robin. I mean, stealing the poor to give to the rich. No? The taxpayers paying the poor bankers. I had the idea of beginning a campaign, an international campaign, but later my evil friends didn't, as usual, didn't accompany me, because it was a charity campaign with a beautiful slogan: "Adopt a banker." Can you imagine? isn't it moving? I thought it was a great idea, but I'm soy un incomprendido. A mí no me entiende nadie. It's a question about Mario Benedetti, a great friend of mine who recently died, a Uruguayan writer. And he was almost 90 years old. And he was an exceptional man. A very good writer, but overall an exceptional man. And an exceptional writer in a not very frequent virtue in our syndicate. He was a very generous person. He and Julio Cortázar, perhaps, were the only writer's friend of mine who I experienced this strange situation. Both of them were generous enough to celebrate the success of other writers. And it's not frequent. We occupy the jail of the peacocks in the zoo, human zoo. No? And so when some other writer receive a prize or is successful or is selling well or receives well reviews, good reviews, most of us will suffer a liver attack immediately, internado en emergencia. In Mario, no. In Julio, no. So we miss them. We certainly miss them, both of them, Julio and Mario. What do you gather of the current leftist shift in Latin America politics? Promising or not? Certainly. Certainly promising. We are recovering the enthusiasm, the lost enthusiasm. It's a beautiful word, entusiasmo. Almost the same in English because they have the same origin. It's a Greek word, which originally meant to have the gods inside. It's beautiful. And I think now we're living in almost all Latin America, with some exceptions, this experience. We are recovering our capacity of having the gods inside. And we are applying some lessons learned from the common sense. And this is also something very stimulating and healthy. For instance, President Correa in Ecuador decides that Ecuador will pay the foreign debt, but only the legitimate debt. Only the legitimate debt, because the big banks and the international financial institutions were very generous with military dictatorships and with corrupt politicians. And so why should the people pay for the stick that striked him, beat him,
mm-hmm.
and for the robbery it suffered? So many corrupt politicians, so many loans that never arrived, lost in the way, lost in translation, I don't know. And so when Correa said, we'll stop paying these sort of things, we are not paying anymore, we'll pay legitimate debt. And then it was a scandal. And everybody, it was before the catastrophe in Wall Street, but everybody was announcing that Ecuador would go into bankruptcy. This country is shipwrecking, I mean. What a disaster. Well, Ecuador is very good, no problem at all. And the profits of the disaster suffered them, the disaster they were announcing. And the same thing with Evo Morales in Bolivia. It's just acts of common sense he's applying. Bolivia is a country with Indian majority. But it's now being refounded. There is something like a rebirth of Bolivia. is becoming Bolivia for the first time. During all the independent period, and of course before in colonial times, Bolivia was not Bolivia. The first constitution of Bolivia, which at its birth was called Republica Bolivar, was handwritten by Bolivar himself. And it was a very beautiful constitution, except for a little detail. It gave citizenship only to the 3 or 4% of the population. Because Bolivar, who was a hero and a man with bright ideas, was also a man of his time and his class. And so, of course, in the constitution, women had no rights, and Indians also, because the constitution obliged citizens to speak and read correctly in Spanish language. And in Bolivia, just a minority at that time spoke in Spanish, a minority of minorities. And now Bolivia is rediscovering itself as a nation of everybody, you know, and not as the monopoly of a few people who are owning power and owning everything else. It's also an act of common sense. It's very strange that common sense appears in the world. No? For instance, the 35 hours of work in France. Some years ago, I don't remember now, perhaps 10 years or 12, the French government decided to limit the quantity of hours to be worked each week, and it would be up to 35 and no more, applying also common sense. Because what for are the machines? The machines were invented to make easier human life. And it's a paradox of this system, upside down system, el mundo al revés, that the machines, for instance, the car was invented to make easier the transport. Human transport. And now, in this civilization of wheels instead of legs, we are absolutely blockaded by the cars, because the cars own the cities, and sometimes we are intruders in the cities we created, and the cars gives orders to us. In Spain, for instance, cars occupy half of each noticiero, how is it, news in the radio or television. The first half is consecrated to cars. Where you can go, where you can't, where it is difficult to go on or not difficult. Los tapones del tráfico, the traffic jams. Jams.
Yes,
no?
We're very familiar with them here. Jams.
Here
yes,
also,
yes.
The jams, yes. There are some, Los Angeles also has some experience on it. But it was perfect, the idea of the French government saying, well, if we have machines, let's increase the time, the human time for freedom and pleasure. And let's reduce the time to work, because we work to live, but we should not live to work. This was common sense. I knew from the beginning that it could not it could not go long.
Edward,
and it didn't. It Sarkozy finished it last year. And now
finished.
Everybody can accept the orders of the master and work 5,000 hours per week.
But we just have a little more time. I'm wondering if you might tell us that story you were telling me in the green room about the priest that you met in Tijuana, because we're in a library. Such a beautiful story.
Yeah, there is a library in one library in Tijuana, and I was now in Santa Fe with priest, Jesuit priest, who was the main author of this miracle. And it was something at least, no, one library. But on the other side of the frontier, they have a lot of libraries. It's part of a system interested in having ignorant people and avoiding the risk of people beginning reading dangerous books, like mine.
Do you worry at all about the change, what's happening with newspapers? As you know, here in Los Angeles, this is a huge city, and our newspaper is shrinking. And obviously, we're in a period of changing in terms of how people get information. What do you think is how we're going to move through that transition?
Yeah, for me, it's terrible because I come from the Gutenberg's era. I mean, I love paper. I'm unable to read a newspaper or a book in screen. Sorry, but that's the way it is. I mean, I belong to the Paleolithic era or something like this. And a book is much more than an object. It's something accompanying you. If it's a good book, if it's really inside the words saying what you want to hear or you need to hear, and it has a smell and it has a volume and you can touch it. And I don't know. I'm prehistoric. Absolutely reactionary. I understand that these technological changes are perhaps inevitable and unavoidable, and that they will go on. But on the other way, I think that so many complaints about the crisis of the newspapers or the crisis of cars, for instance, two of the main subjects in the media, tears and tears, because the newspapers are in crisis. Well, some of the newspapers, it's a good news that they are in crisis, and less lies. And the same thing about the car crisis. I mean, less cars, from the point of view of nature, less poison. From the point of view of pedestrian, less killed people in the streets. Sometimes we are so trained to accept lies that we don't have a clear idea about it, no?
Time for probably two more questions before we move to the book signing.
There are a lot of questions about the art of writing and the destiny of literature and so on. In my master's, where did I learn to write? In the cafes. I have no formal education. I had only 6 years in primary school, later 1 year in the secondary school, and that was all. I learned the art of telling stories in the cafes of Montevideo. I am a son of the cafes of Montevideo. And so many anonymous storytellers. I began working when I was very young, 13, 14 years old, but I didn't like to study at all, especially history, because I found it as something so boring, terribly boring. And I felt that pastime was something not related to me, with no connection with my real life, my desires, my nothing. It was in the cafes that I discovered that the past could become present, if it was told in such a way that what happened happens again while it's being told. I remember one of the situations. I don't know if I shall be able to tell it in English, but it was, I never wrote it. In one of the cafes that existed, and they don't exist anymore, just we have one surviving cafe, because it's not a good business. I mean, and now, which is not rentable?
Profitable.
Doesn't deserve to exist. And then it's very difficult to have these lost places of encounters from the time in which everybody had time to waste time, to lose time. Was the best way to win it. And once I heard, I was 15 or 16 years old, one of the many stories I heard that changed my destiny, my life. When I discovered I could be a storyteller, and that this was my real vocation. He was an old man, but not so old as accept his version of what he was telling. He said he was in a battlefield at the beginning of the 20th century, in the years of civil war in Uruguay. And by his age, this was not exactly possible, but okay. Sometimes art is a lie which tells the truth. So, and he was walking among the corpses after a battle, and there he found among the dead an angel with the arms open like in a cross, unbelievably beautiful and young. And he had a ribbon on the front, as all the soldiers, our soldiers in the Civil War. There were a ribbon, white or red. It depended on which side they were. This young angel, dead, wore a ribbon, a white ribbon, and he was covered by blood, but the ribbon was intact, the white ribbon. And there was an inscription, badly written by hand. The inscription said, "For my fatherland and for her." And the bullet have entered in the word her. And so I was amazed, because I was so moved by something that I have heard in the history classes in Uruguay. I have heard a lot of stories about what happened at the beginning of our century, the 20th century. But none of them had really reached me as something I could feel, I could really feel like, this is mine, I am this dead man. And finally, my masters, well, I have a lot of masters. No? I spoke about Mark Twain, Ambrose Bierce, I can speak about Rulfo, Ronetti, or so many. And especially a princess called Sherezade. Sherezade was the best storyteller in all human history. And she was exchanging each story for a new day of life. The king had the disagreeable habit of marrying at dusk and decapitating his new wife at sunrise. Sherezade was the only one who could save her life, exchanging one tale for each new day of life. But when she was telling her stories, at the light of the moon, feeling pleasure and giving pleasure. Sometimes she felt a strange blow of wind in her neck, and it was clearly the king announcing the worst. And from there comes the first commandment in the art of writing, of telling stories. It's forbidden to be boring.
And Eduardo, please come and tell us stories again. Thank you so very, very much. Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KUSC 91.5 FM and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.